Israeli facilities are not a gift from Israel. There are legal Palestinian rights, and this move shows that the Palestinian outrage forced the Israeli regime to submit to the Palestinian demands partially. Palestinians have the right to defend themselves and their lands, and the resistance will go on until a complete lifting of the siege.
Palestinians here stress that the popular resistance should be held along with the armed resistance until all Palestinian demands are completely achieved. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
In a small lab in Tehran, a big dream is unfolding. An expert team comprised of over 30 young Iranian physicists and engineers are putting the first building blocks of what would be the first Iranian-made particle accelerator, also called synchrotron. The device produces high-energy beams by accelerating electrons close to the speed of light in a large donut-shaped vacuum chamber. The process seems simple in words, but it's painstakingly complicated in practice.
At the center of this laboratory complex, a fourth-generation synchrotron is located, which accelerates electrons to nearly the speed of light by using radio frequency systems and powerful electromagnets, and finally produces exceptionally brilliant beams of light in a wide spectrum ranging from infrared and visible light to ultraviolet and hard X-rays.
First built in the 1940s, synchrotrons were originally made to study high-energy particle collisions, but it didn't take scientists long to notice the synchrotron's byproduct, an extremely bright light that can be used in investigating the structure of crystals and proteins, monitoring air pollution, studying disease mechanisms, HD imaging, and cancer radiation therapy, among other applications.
The X-ray produced in this machine is a million times brighter than the other conventional X-ray sources, and it has also unique properties such as high coherency and polarization, tunability, and ultra-short pulses, which enables the scientists to achieve high-quality imaging. Information obtained by scientists can be used to study the structure of viruses and proteins, design new drugs, precise radiography from human body, examine the structure of surfaces, build smaller and powerful computer chips, develop new materials for safer medical implants, and help with the cleanup of mining waste.
The Iranian synchrotron is for now in the R&D stage. The developer's team says the project needs $300 million to be accomplished. So far, only 1% of the budget is supplied. The team hopes by shedding light on the significance of the cutting-edge technology, it can attract the needed investment from the government.
With a wide range of applications, from medicine to agriculture, the homegrown synchrotron would transform technologies. Experts say, for sanctions hit Iran, building such a device is more than just an achievement, but a miracle. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
"We are all in this together" has been the slogan echoed repeatedly throughout the COVID-19 global health pandemic. But time and time again, it's been proven to be little more than intelligent brand marketing, as the global health crisis has laid bare not only the inequalities within societies, but also on the global stage. In Africa, considered the most resource-rich continent on the planet, but the poorest in terms of GDP, less than 2% of the continent's population of 1.3 billion has been fully vaccinated against COVID-19. While in comparison, in the European Union, 70% of adults have now been fully vaccinated, according to EU officials, leading to allegations of COVID apartheid in the international arena.
Some countries are now rolling out booster doses to fully vaccinated people, when millions of people around the world have not even received their first dose.
Israel has provided a million Israelis their third dose, while only 18% of Palestinians in Gaza have received only one dose of the COVID vaccine.
Meanwhile, the UK, a former colonial power in Africa, is the latest to offer a third dose of the COVID vaccine to around 500,000 Brits. At a time when Africa is experiencing 248,000 new confirmed cases just last week, and 28 African countries are in the midst of a surge in infections driven by the new Delta variant.
And today we're going to go a step further by accepting the advice of the independent JCVI that anyone that is severely immunosuppressed should be offered a third dose.
A According to research conducted by the Zoe COVID study, effectiveness in the Pfizer vaccine was at 88% after 1 month, but dropped to 74% after 6 months. And for AstraZeneca, the effectiveness of the vaccine was 77% after 1 month, but dropped to 67% after 4 to 5 months. This arguably demonstrates the need for third booster jabs. However, in low-income countries where there are fewer healthcare workers, weaker infrastructure, and poor access to COVID vaccines, that need is far greater. But their cry for help has thus far been ignored by the very powers that told us we are all in this together. Ahmed Kabbalah, London.
Despite intense negotiations, the Taliban and the National Resistance Front in Panjshir, headed by Ahmed Massoud, have not reached a peace agreement. As a result, the Taliban launched a major offensive from three directions on the valley of Panjshir on Wednesday night to capture an area that has yet to fall under the group's control.
Taliban have had some offensive from the Khawak High Pass, from the Andarab Valley of Baghla. From our side, there were local forces of Andarab, different districts of Andarab, local forces of Panjshir, as well as the ANSF forces. They have defended very well. They have defeated Taliban on that front. Taliban have lost 40 of their personnel, another 35 of them were wounded. 4 armies of Taliban were destroyed, 2 rangers of Taliban were destroyed, and they did not succeed on their offensive.
In the meantime, the Taliban officials say the resistance in Panjshir cannot succeed because the valley is completely surrounded by the Taliban forces. Therefore, the Taliban want Massoud to surrender without any bloodshed, a demand strongly rejected by the resistance in Panjshir.
We want Massoud to surrender. We are all Muslims and we must not kill each other. Panjshir is surrounded by our forces and we will finally capture the valley. So this is better for Massoud to think about the consequences of resisting against us.
Capturing Panjshir Valley in northern Afghanistan has always been considered a big goal for the Taliban, even during their previous rule over 95% of Afghanistan before their collapse in 2001. Ahmad Shah Massoud resisted against major Taliban offensives on Panjshir and did not allow them to enter the valley even once. Now, it remains to be seen if Ahmad Massoud, the son of the legendary Afghan commander, can follow the footsteps of his father, who is also titled as the Afghan national hero in Afghanistan's constitution. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Pakistan has stepped up security along the Afghan border. The move is part of several measures Pakistan has taken to prevent militants slipping into this side of the border. But these moves appear to have made little impact as the number of terrorist attacks has been on the rise in recent weeks. A report by an Islamabad-based think tank reveals that in August, 45 militant attacks took place in Pakistan, the highest in a month since June 2016.
Interestingly, the sudden surge in militant attacks in Pakistan, almost twice as compared with July, was witnessed in a month in which Taliban took over Afghanistan, especially Kabul. So there is a coincidence. It is yet to be verified that is there a direct link or not, but it is a strange coincidence.
According to the report, the number of militant attacks continued to go up since May when the US-led foreign forces started withdrawing from Afghanistan. Most of those attacks were carried out by Pakistani Taliban or Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan. Some experts link the rise in militant attacks with Afghan Taliban releasing a number of anti-Pakistan terrorists from jail.
This is because of the security vacuum which has been created, number one, in Afghanistan. And number two, the districts which have been captured by Afghan Taliban, on those districts, TTP prisoners have been released. Along with them, a number of other terrorists have been released. So this fresh wave of terrorism in Pakistan is linked with the Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, which is a banned organization.
The TTP was driven out of Pakistan's erstwhile tribal areas after the country conducted a military campaign in 2015. However, Pakistan says the group still operates out of Afghanistan. Pakistan hopes the incoming government in Afghanistan will take decisive action against the TTP. But observers are skeptical if Afghan Taliban will do that, given these militant groups often share the same ideology. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
The International Atomic Energy Agency has reported that North Korea has likely restarted its Yongbyon nuclear power plant, the source of fissile material for its nuclear weapons. The news adds pressure to the U.S. to enter talks with Pyongyang, with the White House facing questions. Well, we have left the door open and obviously reached out through our channels. I don't have an update for you in terms of any response to our offer. Our offer remains to meet anywhere, anytime, without preconditions. North Korea has not accepted U.S. President Biden's administration's offer of talks because Pyongyang would like to see an end to what it views as a hostile U.S. policy toward it. In particular, Pyongyang bristles at the U.S.-led United Nations Security Council sanctions, which restrain North Korea's international trade, and the periodic military exercises involving some 28,500 U.S. troops in South Korea. Experts at this week's Korea Global Forum for Peace argue Washington needs to do more.
The North maintains that the Biden administration has not proposed specific or concrete incentives. The U.S. is simply calling on the North to return to the dialogue table, but for North Korea, they need to have some tangible outcome from the talks.
The previous summits between North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and former U.S. President Donald Trump gained headlines but changed little. With the dispatch of his North Korean nuclear envoy to the U.S. this week, South Korean President Moon Jae-in clearly recognizes time's not on his side, with a presidential election here slated to replace him next March. For U.S. President Joe Biden, however, the North Korean nuclear issue competes on a crowded agenda, with Washington's recent withdrawal from Afghanistan and a surge in COVID-19 cases in the U.S.
Still, the South Korean president seems determined to bring the U.S. and North Korea closer to the negotiating table. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi, kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Now, the United States is anything but united these days. Inside the country lies much discontent and a major divide. And outside the country, even Washington's allies are starting to say that the U.S. hegemony is waning rapidly, especially after the Afghanistan debacle. Are we looking at the beginning of the end of the American empire, or are we rapidly approaching its dissolution? Stay with us as we take a look at all of this and more on this Spotlight.
Weeks after the Taliban swept to power in Afghanistan, the world is still evaluating the results of the West's 20-year-long war in the country. The United States have faced criticism over its messy withdrawal from Afghanistan and its achievements in the Central Asian country. The unexpectedly rapid fall of the Afghan capital, the scenes of chaos at the Kabul International Airport where hundreds of people desperate to leave the country had gathered, and the bomb attack claimed by the Daesh terror group that killed over 170 people, including 13 U.S. troops, have all raised questions about the U.S. military superiority. That's an issue British Defense Secretary Ben Wallace raised in an interview with The Spectator magazine.
It's obvious that Britain is not a superpower, but a superpower that is also not prepared to stick at something isn't probably a superpower either. It is certainly not a global force, it's just a big power.
This wasn't the first time that the British Defense Secretary has criticized Washington, a close UK ally. Back in August, he said former US President Donald Trump's decision to clinch a deal with the Taliban was a mistake.
I would say if it's a superpower or not is pretty irrelevant. The United States is still the greatest danger facing the world and the greatest concentration of private power against our species that has ever existed.
While the U.S. threatens military action against nations it deems its adversaries, including Iran, Russia, and China, it appears that more Washington allies are beginning to take up the opinion that America has lost its superpower status.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the Spotlight, Senior Analyst, Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams out of New York. And journalist and political analyst Elijah Matnia out of Brussels.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you both for being with us. Let's start this off with Ian in New York. Ian, do you think that the U.S. is waning? And if so, when do you think this actually started? Some say from 1971 when gold no longer backed the dollar. Others say since the U.S. invaded Afghanistan and Iraq. I mean, what's your assessment of this overall?
It's very difficult to say. Oh, it's been waning almost the minute it was established because people successfully stood against it. You could say that the Vietnamese victory against the U.S. was a clear signal, but it was definitely at its height after the fall of the Berlin Wall, after the fall of the Soviet Union, and with the Iraq War. The U.S. was unchallenged internationally. Even its enemies didn't really dare go against it. That's been eroded totally. But what happened in Afghanistan was not significant in economic or military terms. It was significant in terms of prestige, which, as far as global diplomacy is concerned, is almost as important But people are still going to think twice before they challenge the US. They still have hugely disproportionate armed forces. They still have hugely disproportionate financial support, less so than it was, and it's definitely waning, and a lot less quickly than some of us would have hoped, perhaps. But it's also got rising, it's got rising rivals, in particular China. I don't really think that Russia is one of the major rivals. It's Russia is sort of Saudi Arabia with nuclear weapons. It doesn't have a massive economy, but it does have this residual armed forces and nuclear weapons. China is a rising power in every sense, and obviously the US is scared about it. But once again, the US isn't unrivaled there, and China can't really exploit the US's weakness, because one of the reasons why China has been rising is because it sells so much of its goods to the United States, and it borrows so much money from the United States, it lends so much money to the United States, so they're inextricably bound together. It's not a straight one-on-one superpower confrontation like Moscow and Washington in what you might say the bad old days, when they really didn't have that much to do with each other. There was almost minimal contact in culturally, financially, and other ways. But the United States is a victim of its own failures.
Stay with me. Let me. We're going to talk about the reasons for this. But let me get Elijah in on this conversation. Now, American political scientist Francis Fukuyama says that the truth of the matter is that the end of the American era had come much earlier. The long-term sources of American weakness and decline are more domestic than international. What do you think about that?
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming.
I think the decline of the U.S. forces started not when the U.S. was engaged in war, like in Lebanon 1982 or 1983, in Iraq in 2003, in Syria 2011. It is, what is the outcome of all these wars? Of course, the U.S. has the strongest military machine and military power, but what is the result of this machine? Winning the ground and then not be able to hold it. It's exactly the same as ISIS is able today to attack small villages and win and then withdraw. But the U.S. is able to stay for much longer, for many years, and then being kicked out and forced to withdraw. The moment the Americans sit with the Taliban and negotiate a peace deal is the moment of the decline and the defeat of the U.S. after 20 years. So there is no point for the U.S. to have so much the mighty military power when the result is very slim at the end of the day. So yes, it is a decline of the empire. It is the rising of other forces that not only are rival, but also are defying the U.S. and challenging the U.S. Forces, even if they don't stand to the exact U.S. Military power, and they have a minor force. But however, they can and they are able to defy the U.S., like we've seen that in Iran, we've seen that in Syria, we've seen that in Lebanon, and we've seen that in Iraq, even a small group. And the Taliban managed to stand against the Americans and force the withdrawal. So, yes, I think the U.S. Defense Secretary is quite right by saying it is just a big power, but it's big power not able to achieve anything at the end of the day.
Okay, well, Ian, there have always been different opinions in the U.S., like most places, but it was magnified greatly during the Trump era. How divided do you actually think the country is currently?
It's extremely divided. And I just want to add that the people who brought you the Iraq War were the people behind the project for the new American century. And they foresaw this precisely. In their own way, they were clear-sighted. They said America was declining economically, and so they had to cement in a military advantage now to ensure the hegemony over the next few years. And they're proved entirely right, apart from the fact of being hopelessly optimistic. And what we're seeing now is that there is no... There's always been a problem with American foreign policy. It's never been... It's never been joined up. It's a result of different lobbies of forces within the... It's almost Byzantine in the way that the State Department, the Pentagon, the military industrial contractors, the politicians representing the lobbies, where they kick things around until it comes. And then, in the past, you had the State Department acting like a gyroscope and saying, well, yes, you might want that, but international law says no. Jerusalem is not Israel's capital. Or international law says no, Western Sahara is not part of Morocco, no matter what the President of the United States says. But that type of moderating influence is almost gone, because one of the things that Trump and the ideologues did was to wage a complete war against the State Department and the more rational aspects of the American foreign policy establishment. So in that sense, what Joe Biden has done is entirely rational. He said, we can't win in Afghanistan. Afghanistan is not one of our essential, it's not one of our essential fields of operation for the United States. The United States' interests are not inextricably bound up there. Prestige might be, but we can live with their prestige. We're still the biggest military in the world. And then, the old story about sticks and stones may break my bones, but the names will not be okay. I'm not the big superpower. Try anything on me and see what I do. It's a rational position that Biden has taken, but it is symbolic of American decline and the decline of the decision-making apparatus that universally the political, military, and intelligence people let Biden down so thoroughly that he did not know that the Taliban had basically entered into an agreement and they bought the Afghan army wholesale on the ground, unit by unit.
You talked about that it's the logical thing to do, the rational thing to do. I think probably the question, though, for the American people and much of the world would be the way that they did what they did and why that they leave in the way that they did and cause such chaos. And what does that do to the American psyche itself? Because the American people, first of all, don't like to believe that they've been beaten, that they've lost the war, number one. And second of all, they don't like to hear that some have been left behind and basically American troops are running out of Afghanistan. I mean, what has that done in general for the American psyche inside of the country?
The American psyche, as far as I can see, is completely unflappable. Really, they really don't care. Afghanistan is a faraway country with a strange-sounding name, and most Americans are just happy to get out of there. Some of them might see it as a blot on their escutcheon, another way of looking at it, if you're being rational, bearing in mind that it was a completely unprecedented collapse, that was the real failure, the fact that wasn't anticipated. The U.S. showed its power. It got out over 100,000 people in a very short time from allegedly a hostile territory with very few casualties and very few left behind. It's shameful, but actually that shame is mostly brought on by the Trump people who brought about the debacle to begin with, who are picking on Biden for partisan points. I'm not a fan of Biden, but this was one of the more rational things, and a lot of what he's been accused of goes squarely back to Donald Trump and the Republicans who started this thing. Okay. Now, Biden was one of the cheerleaders for those foreign adventures as part of the sort of neocon conspiracy to defend Israel. But on this particular aspect, he was clear-sighted. We couldn't win enough, and we have to get out.
Elijah, your assessment of it all, and what do you see as the main causes of the U.S.'s deterioration?
I think there are many points here. It is not only the rush that the U.S. left Afghanistan. It is also the behavior toward the allies. I mean, here, Europe is under shock to see how the U.S. withdrew without even consulting Europe, and the way they withdrew without talking to the allies. And this is why we're here today to talk about the necessity to form a European army, which is very early, and I don't know where this is going to lead us. However, the reason why the U.S. felt in such a hurry to leave is because they had the wrong information, wrong assessment of the army that they have trained, and they had a very high expectation.
How does that happen? Sorry to jump in here, Elijah. I mean, how does that happen? You say wrong assessment. 20 years on the ground, 20 years American troops working or being side by side with Afghan troops, obviously evaluating the situation. How do you get it so wrong after 20 years?
Because the Americans make mistakes after mistakes. This is not the first time. And when because they lack also the understanding of the culture, they made this mistake in Iraq severely, and they did it again in Afghanistan when they expected to see the Afghan army engage in a civil war against other Afghani while they are negotiating with them in Qatar and delivering the country back to the Taliban. And they expect the army to fight and give them just 6 months' time so they can pull out all the Americans and the Afghan collaborators. And they say, done, we are out, and now you can continue fighting until you kill each other, and Taliban will again overwhelm all the army that we've trained for 20 years. This is a real failure that we've seen also in Iraq in 2014, where they've trained the army for 11 years, and the Iraqi army crumbled in just 3 days in Mosul and in the north of Iraq. It is not only the failure of the intelligence services, it is not the lack of visibility and right assessment, it is not only the non-understanding of the state and the local culture, it is just everything was going wrong. And because they think, well, the Americans think, we can import our culture anywhere we go, this is fundamentally wrong. They are never going to change the culture of a country, and it's never going to be customized to the Americans' culture and mentality. Nobody asked the Americans to come, and nobody asked, and they were forced to leave. After 20 years, they removed the Taliban in 2001 to give back the power in 2021 again to the Taliban.
Ian, even during a pandemic and health crisis, we have seen anything but solidarity in the way the American society has approached the issue. I mean, do you attribute this to a major mistrust by many of their leadership overall? And how does this affect the whole, the schism that has come about inside of the country? Is there overall mistrust for the leadership?
Well, I mean, you quoted at the beginning Francis Fukuyama, who wrote just before the end of the Cold War about after the end of the Cold War about the end of history, when in fact history had just restarted where it left off in 1914. And to give him his due, Francis Fukuyama has admitted he was wrong about that thesis. And here, in effect, we're seeing the American Civil War still continuing after 160 years. I mean, the issues of race and privilege and culture are still hugely predominant here. I mean, we have Texas just passed an act which basically encourages vigilantism against women. We have almost post-Reconstruction states legislatures all over the South enacting legislation that makes it almost impossible for minorities and poor people to vote. And this is being done without interference on the federal level. We have a party which tried to stage a coup against its own government on January the 6th. We have a failed president who's proclaiming he's still won. These are not the hallmarks of a sophisticated and balanced society. This is a society that's riven down the middle, and there are people who hate each other. You know, 30-40% of Americans don't believe you can be patriotic and a Democrat. They certainly don't believe you can be patriotic and a socialist. They have their own very peculiar definitions, and it's a society that's based on exclusion and hatred on their part. They are actually dying in thousands because they think that wearing masks is a form of subservience to socialism, to galloping communism. They're refusing vaccinations in the middle of a death-dealing plague. I mean, you know, it's difficult. The German word is schadenfreude, to take pleasure of the misfortunes and others. But I can't help grinning every time I see the latest right-wing radio commentator dying of COVID after he's run his latest rampage about vaccination and masks. They're still dying, though. Until they hit the hospital bed and the tubes are rammed down their throats, what's coming the other way out of their throats are invocations to resist the government, resist masks, watch out for those Democrats, they're coming after your daughters and everything else. It really is a very sick society, and it goes back to the Civil War, but it was Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan who saw those fissures were still there and started the process of enlarging the fissures, of basically playing the race card, which they've done year after year. And now it's an even bigger, it's a culture card, where, you know, any minorities are the target for vilification and witch hunts. It's not a stable society. And what's worse is that the people who actually make the decisions in Washington, the last 20 years of hollowing out by the Republicans, they've taken away, for years, if you spoke Arabic in the State Department, you were denied promotion. And you were talking about how could they? When the Shah was driven out of Tehran, U.S. mission people were still sending back rosy reports because none of them read Farsi. They didn't see all the graffiti on the street walls saying death to the Shah on their way in. They probably thought it was an advert for Coca-Cola. They did not know what was happening in the country they were stationed in because of their cultural arrogance.
Well, what about that, Elijah? I mean, now when we look at the situation and the overall situation of the U.S., many will say that it's a dying empire. It's under lots of pressure right now as far as its so-called prestige in the world. Other analysts will say it's some of the most dangerous times when an empire feel pressured. Your take on where this can go with the United States basically waning, as Ian said at the beginning, it may be waning, but it still has a lot of power. Your assessment of it at this point in time?
I think we are in a very dangerous situation today. The danger comes from an administration that wants to show that it has not been defeated and it still had the power to do something. And that will take us to the possibility of American just supporting another war somewhere or a battle between in West Asia. Secondly, the Americans, if they are smart enough to understand that they cannot sustain a presence in country where there is no interest to stay, like, for example, in northeast Syria, that is even exactly the same as Afghanistan, is so far, there is no interest for the Americans to stay there. It's staying in Iraq when the population, half of the population at least, is against them and carrying a tax. So if they reach this realization that it is time to stop being involved in country that are far, there is no interest for the American, and they have to withdraw, then the world will be really in a better shape.
Okay.
Otherwise, you see really an American administration committing one mistake after another.
Well, Ian, really quickly, I just have a minute, though. But what Elijah said, if they will do this and understand that it's not in their benefit, but one of the things we can look at is, yes, the U.S. hasn't spent a lot of money on its own people and the infrastructure, but it has spent trillions on its wars, and it has benefited the industrial military complex, the 1%. I mean, are we going to see a change? Because basically, what the U.S. is like a major corporation and supporting that 1%. All the others are basically just workers for that 1%. Do you think that we're likely to see a change in tactics, or is it just going to continue until it dissolves?
Actually, I think the Biden administration has done, well, I had low expectations. I think they've done far more than I anticipated in terms of rising the corner for the weaker segments of American society. They're not doing enough, but it's far better. And speaking of weaker segments, I think you mentioned the UK before. The UK, for the last 70 years, has droned on about the special relationship, and it's been revealed once again to be entirely one-sided. Britain sends troops to every war that the Americans send to them. These are the equivalents of the sepoys, the Indian colonial army that the British sent everywhere. So So the British have been sent by the Americans to wars all over the world for things that aren't in British interests, were in American interests. And then they were left in Kabul with no attempt to rescue them or consult with them. They were left swinging, like all the other European allies, as Elijah said. I mean, this... If Biden is to be accused of anything, that complete insouciance and contempt for allies will come back to haunt them. The Europeans are going to try and build their own forces. The Taiwanese are going to think to themselves, and the Japanese even are going to think, maybe we need nuclear weapons. If this is what allies do to each other, we need to stand up for ourselves. There are dangerous implications everywhere. There are worse things than a bipolar system. A multipolar system with lots of people waving nukes could be much more dangerous.
Okay, 30 seconds, Elijah. 30 seconds.
I think it's time for the U.S. to realize that stop interfering in other countries' affairs, lift the sanction on Iran, allow Iraq to sort out this problem, and countries in West Asia to talk to each other and keep away, really keep away, and withdraw all forces. That is a dream. It may come true.
All right, and on that note, I appreciate both of you being with me here on this Spotlight, Senior Analyst Foreign Policy and Focus Ian Williams out of New York, and Journalist and Political Analyst Elijah McNair out of Brussels. And we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The United Kingdom will not sweep away the Northern Ireland Brexit protocol, despite renewed calls for its abolition by the Democratic Unionist Party, the DUP, Britain's Brexit Minister David Frost has said. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's Brexit correspondent Lisa O'Carroll. The piece is titled, David Frost, Irish Sea Row risks damaging UK-EU relations long-term. United Kingdom will not sweep away the Northern Ireland Brexit protocol despite renewed calls for its abolition by the Democratic Unionist Party, the DUP, Britain's Brexit Minister David Frost has said. However, David Frost renewed his demands for fundamental changes to its implementation, warning the row could have a long-term chilling effect on wider EU-UK relations unless it was resolved. I worry that if we didn't solve this issue, it is capable of generating the sorts of cold mistrust which will last between us and the European Union. And the mistrust will spread across the whole relationship and will hold back the potential for a new era of cooperation between us in a world which does need us to work together, he said at the British-Irish Association conference in Oxford on Saturday, 4th of September. The row over the protocol, known in some quarters as sausage wars, blew up within days of Brexit being enforced back in January, with barriers imposed for the first time for trade of food, plants and medicines from Great Britain. But with talks set to resume, David Frost told the meeting of senior public figures that triggering Article 16 and suspending the Northern Ireland Protocol was not his preferred option, even though the threshold for such a move had been met. Some would like us to sweep everything away. That's not our position, David Frost told the delegates at the conference. He called on the European Union to engage seriously with proposals for radical changes to the protocol published in a United Kingdom government command paper in July, arguing the proposals do not remove the Northern Ireland protocol and actually retain controls in the Irish Sea for certain purposes. He said society would not forgive either side if they did not make the small muscle movements needed to make the protocol work. When one looks at the price of failure or success and sets it against other challenges that we face in COVID recovery and Afghanistan, one wonders what future generations would say if the impasse is not broken. We have no interest at all in having a fractious and difficult relationship with the European Union, he said. David Frost was speaking just hours after the Irish Prime Minister said at the same conference in Oxford that unilateral moves by the United Kingdom would always be doomed to failure, arguing that history showed partnerships were the only route to success. Talks over implementation of the Northern Ireland Protocol have continued between officials in London and Brussels over the summer, but senior sources say engagement is slow, and it is unlikely an agreement will be reached by 30th of September, indicating talks will extend into the winter months. David Frost said the protocol had to be modified to recognize two sovereign and autonomous entities, not a relationship of subordination or one where one party's rules have to be applied mechanically by the other. The Northern Ireland Secretary, Brandon Lewis, told the same conference in Oxford that the United Kingdom was powering ahead with plans to level up Northern Ireland by announcing a £730 million investment into the new Peace Plus programme to support economic stability, peace and reconciliation in Northern Ireland. Brandon Lewis spoke about the economic successes of the region, including the development of a large cybersecurity sector employing 2,300 staff, but said overall it still punches well below its weight, with pockets of unacceptable levels of deprivation, and much more to be done on segregation in schools in Northern Ireland, with just 7% of children benefiting from integrated education.
Good morning! of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio.